Hey, welcome back to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I am Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And, well, it kind of feels like hockey is over.
Why?
Because the Bruins haven't played in, like, a fortnight.
That's true.
Like, I mean, countries have been overthrown in less time than the Bruins have had to take off. Wars have been won or lost in that time. And they haven't played in 11 days, and now they'll play the St. Louis Blues. Basketball season, obviously, as we talked about last week with the New England fans, once your team's out, it's if the team doesn't win the whole thing, it's rebuilding time.
Oh, absolutely.
Just forget it. Like, burn it to the ground.
Especially right now in Boston.
Right.
Every other team's going to win the championship. The Celtics are a mess, comparatively.
The Celtics are a comparative mess to everybody else. But as it always happens, and it's somewhat frustrating around here, you know, there are many things that I enjoy about living here, but one of the things that's weird is once the season ends for the Boston team, the season might as well be over.
Right.
Like, with the Dodgers are in the World Series, what was it, 2 years ago against the Astros, and I'm bleary-eyed attempting to work, and, oh, people, how are you, you know, asking about, you know, how you're feeling today, and I'm exhausted. I was up all night watching the World Series game. Oh, who's playing? Like, whereas if the Red Sox are in it and we're all up until 2 in the morning watching the game,
everyone would look the same.
Everybody looks the same, and it's kind of like, it's okay. It's accepted that you can be a New England sports fan. Even if you're not a New England sports fan, you can just have a horrible hangover and people will assume that you watch the game.
Right.
But far, you know, you are not really allowed to be a fan of a team that is from anywhere else because nobody else cares.
Right. Well, with that layoff that with the Bruins that you're talking about, it is a problem. And I'll give you my one hockey stat of the show. I heard that of the last 16 Stanley Cup champions, 13 of them came into the finals with less rest than their opponent.
I think there's something to be said for that, particularly in a sport like hockey. Some sports, it's a good thing to have the days off. Obviously, with football, you want to have the days off. They have the 2 weeks between the conference championship game and the Super Bowl, which makes sense and really, I think, has been a contributing factor to the Patriots dynasty. The fact that Belichick gets 2 weeks to watch film, his guys get 2 weeks to watch film, and they get time to scheme. It's the same reason as a USC football fan that USC was a juggernaut back in the early 2000s, well, aside from some of the things that might have cost them some games later. But Pete Carroll was very good at making halftime adjustments, particularly with a longer halftime. And so for that reason, USC would come out of halftime and have a slightly different look. And all of a sudden, it's like, wait a second, they have all these athletes and we're seeing this guy in the field that we haven't seen before. If you give somebody who is a good coach a little bit more time to scheme, that can be to their benefit. A game like hockey is an emotional game. It's a momentum game. And it is a fitness game. And it is tough to simulate game action and game speed in practice.
And conditioning is so huge.
Right.
So you take a few days off. You mend the bumps and bruises, but then pretty quickly you lose that conditioning.
Right. You lose the conditioning, and then that really becomes the problem. So, I would gather that's what the issue is. Although, in the case of the Bruins, they have gotten very good goaltending out of Tuukka Rask. That, to me, you know, for a goalie, too, there's a momentum play that goes along with it as well, and there's a confidence thing that goes along with it. So, I'm curious to see. It has been, I believe, since 1970 that the Blues and the Bruins were in the Stanley Cup Finals together.
Well, that was the last time the Blues were in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Okay, so
and it was against the Bruins. So here they are again.
There they are again. And that one, well known because of Bobby Orr's flying goal that has been memorialized as the statue. So curious to see. I wish I could tell you when it starts, but
Monday.
Yeah, Monday.
Monday.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway, it will continue to be even longer as Boston is devoid of hockey. I mean, 2 weeks ago, we were seeing hail and snow and rainy stuff and just gross weather, and now it feels like spring. So who knows? I hope hockey doesn't bring the bad weather back. Although, so I guess getting back to the hardwood, in New England, we sort of feel like basketball season is over. because it's over for us and we are the center of the universe, obviously.
Obviously.
But there are still games going on. The Golden State Warriors are doing their Warrior thing.
Without Durant.
Without Durant, without Boogie.
Back to the original Warriors crew.
Back to the original. Well, the what has been your favorite piece of this Warriors crew that you have seen with the original Warriors crew?
Well, it's Steph. He's got to be number one. But just watching the way that Steph and Klay and Draymond Green interact and work together and make each other better, that's probably the best team part of it. Because all three of them are so amazing at what they do. Everybody agrees that Steph is the best shooter of all time. And then with Klay, it's the best backcourt, shooting backcourt of all time. And then Draymond is the unicorn power forward who can do everything. And he'll have a stat line with 8 points, 14 rebounds, 12 assists, three blocks, three steals. It's like a... just like a typical playoff night for Draymond Green.
Yeah, that's been my favorite part, is watching Draymond, who's not really a role player, because he does get, when Durant is there, he is reduced to a role player for all intents and purposes, and he's really too good to be a role player. And it's a shame and it's a waste. And when Durant is hurt and when Cousins is hurt, now you have Draymond taking a central role, but it's a different Draymond to the pre-Durant Draymond. It's a guy who has matured a bit. His basketball IQ is off the charts, and I think his IQ is nothing to shrug at either. Like, he's a bright dude and he knows what he's doing, but it's hard. We've all been in that situation where you get into the red a little bit and something happens and you do something you regret. The difference is a lot of us will do it in front of a smaller audience. He's doing it in front of a TV audience, and he's grown up to a point that he's no longer making those sort of silly interpersonal mistakes, and I'm going to knock on wood because I hope
I hope
that holds up, because I think he's a great basketball player. He's entertaining to watch, and he does everything. It's I think back to the early 90s, the guy who was the sort of original guy to fill up the stat sheet with all kinds of weird, nuancy things was Bo Outlaw, the old Clipper, he would have 5 points and five steals and five rebounds and five blocks. And you're like, who is this guy? But he was contributing to a win for his team by doing a bunch of things that were little things. And now the NBA is so stat heavy that you look at a guy like Draymond, who might have been a forgotten player, but not he wouldn't have gotten the accolades now or then that he gets now, because those things are more in favor now than they were then.
He is an absolute stat stuffer, and one place it might show up is the plus minus. He's the guy that just makes so many winning plays that contributes to the championship, everything from those stats that you recognize, but he's also taking charges. He's also switching on defense. He can guard multiple positions. He's just the glue guy on both ends who does everything. You know, offensively, you see the change where instead of the offense running through Durant a lot of the time, and they take advantage of Durant's amazing one-on-one ability, now when Draymond gets it at the top of the key, the first thing he's doing is either looking to pass, or he'll immediately go do a dribble handoff, and he keeps things moving, and he facilitates that offense so well, and he's just the perfect complement to Klay and Steph.
Yeah, that has been a lot of fun to watch, but watching Steph and watching him just rain from everywhere, that's really been a treat. And it's almost supernatural. It's just it's weird to see. And I don't know. You can't we talked about Tiger Woods a lot, with Tiger Woods playing at Stanford and going to hit on the driving range in wind and rain to simulate a condition. I don't know that it's possible to simulate every shot that Steph Curry takes and makes on the court. It's the amount of calculations that are going into that guy's brain as he's hoisting up a shot from 35 feet guarded by somebody. It's astonishing, and I really have no idea how you practice and learn that at all.
Well,
like, it's unfathomable to me.
I mean, a couple things. I think one is, to your point, the way that he gets to his shot, it's a thousand different ways, whether he's off the dribble, whether he's running off a screen. But once he actually squares up, it looks the same every time.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's practiced hundreds of thousands of three-point shots to perfect that perfect shooting form. And so he's just so good at getting into that form, however he gets to his spot. But
right.
the other thing is you'll see him practicing not just the normal shots, but, you know, we talk about the half-court shots. You'll see him shooting from the tunnel before the games, and he's shooting this, you know, 70-foot shot along the baseline, and he's making it quite often. You do that, and you get some confident shooting from that range. Then you move into the 25-foot range. It almost looks like a layup. So I think he does a lot of things with his practice to give him confidence so that, you know, whenever he gets that little bit of an opening, he expects to make it.
Yeah, it's astonishing. It's a really indicative of how the game has changed, too, where years ago it would have been a novelty and nobody would have put it into practice at all. It's still the game still would have. I don't know. I don't know how a guy like Steph Curry would have worked in the late 80s, early 90s in a heavy center power forward type league where the league was predicated on getting the ball down low and banging it into the hoop. I don't know. What do you think? Would he have been a role player or would somebody have figured out how to actually use the guy?
You would have needed a coach and a front offense that was progressive, that would recognize his unique skill and try to highlight it, because you're right, that was just not the norm. And these Celtics-Lakers documentaries, these 30 for 30s, have been on this week. And, you know, just looking at some of those highlights, it's like the entire 10-player grouping on the court lives within 17 feet of the hoop. And working around the perimeter is working it around for the 17-foot baseline jumper. Not like today with the Milwaukee Bucks, who all five guys are starting outside the three-point line. We talked about that this winter.
Right.
And so it would have taken some foresight and some open-mindedness for Steph to thrive in the late 80s like he is today.
Or does he just completely get ignored because he's a little guy and somebody says, well, you know, he's nice and he's a novelty, but he winds up like, you know, Michael Cooper had a good NBA career and he's him or Byron Scott, and I'm thinking more West Coast guys.
And those guys are a lot bigger.
Those guys...
a lot taller.
Cooper was 3 or 4 inches taller than Steph. Byron Scott was maybe an inch or two.
Yeah, maybe a couple inches, but...
But different players, guys who really... The three-point shot was a novelty. It was a lot like hitting a home run was in a baseball game. At that point in time, well, it was 23-9, if memory serves correctly. I honestly don't know what it is now.
It is 23-9.
It's still?
At that point, like late 80s, yeah, same distance from the top. And, you know, one of the stats I heard recently was I think this year in the NBA, the same amount of three-point shots were attempted as the entire 1980s.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
So that just goes to show you this is a completely different era, and Steph Curry easily could have got lost in the shuffle, not only because of the focus on getting it inside, but again, to your point, his size. And the game was a little bit more physical then, and the defensive rules were different. They've changed over the years. So he would have had trouble standing out like he does now, unless he got a chance from somebody.
Right, and that's sort of the biggest thing. He is a product of talent and hard work and really great timing. Like, it's fascinating to see. Or the question then becomes, if he's playing in a league like that, does he become a drive-and-dish guy who occasionally shoots the three? Like, I don't know. It's
and more like a John Stockton.
More like a John Stockton.
Who had a really good shooting form.
Stockton was
but
great.
But he was the pass-first point guard.
He was the pass-first point guard. He was the, I'm going to find Karl Malone on the roll. And the two of them, it was like peanut butter and jelly. So, I mean, but they had some wonderful teams, but they never won a title. So... on the other side, the Bucks stormed out to a 2-0 series lead, and it's I'm struggling with it. There are a few facets to this whole thing. One, I remember like a year ago when Masai Ujiri traded
DeRozan,
or it was slightly less than a year ago, but it was the whole Dwayne Casey thing, and everybody saying this guy's lost his mind. What is he doing? Why is he doing this? And we had had all the conversations about Kawhi Leonard too, about Kawhi being the sort of stereotypical greedy professional athlete. Like, he's just going for a paycheck somewhere. He doesn't want to play with the Spurs. You know how much I like Greg Popovich. So yeah. I guess there are a few things here. So we need to unpack these things. Thing one, the first is Kawhi Leonard is a beast. And you would think with everything you see of him and how humble he seems to be in a post-game interview and how competitive he is on the court and how smart of a player he is, you look at him and you say, he and Popovich seem to be like the perfect marriage.
Yeah, and you know my perspective on this as well. I'm Team Kawhi here. I think the Spurs mishandled that. I think criticizing him in the media, it was just the wrong move. That is not the guy to criticize in the media from your own team.
No, well,
you got to support him. You got to talk behind closed doors. That's just not who he is. And he'd had enough finally, and that's why he wanted out. And so for the folks who would take the angle of, you know, greedy professional, I just don't agree. I think he's all about the right things, and he just wants to go out and play the game. You know, he doesn't even want to talk about the game. He just wants to play it and then come back the next day. And, you know, I mean, you've heard these stories about him having some beat-up pickup truck. I mean, he is about some respect, but he's just about wanting to be treated the right way.
He, in this day and age, this is the NBA. This is the NBA has become Brazilian soccer, where you had the one-name guys, Bebeto and, you know, Ronaldo and everybody like that. The NBA is like that. And you want to get to a point where you're a one-name guy. And Kawhi is a one-name guy. And he's a guy that you can say to even a casual basketball fan, Kawhi, and they know that he plays for the Toronto Raptors. I mean, they have a national following up there, but they have an international following at this point. Like, he is a star. The question also becomes, okay, now he's going to be a free agent. And you hear the talking heads saying, well, he should stay in Toronto. Toronto's the perfect place for him. You have the two LA teams. The Lakers would love to have him. The Clippers would love to have him. And Clippers have more cap space. But you look at a kid who's a Southern California kid. He's from Moreno Valley, which is off the 91 freeway, which is basically, if you're by helicopter half an hour away. If you're a professional athlete, I don't think you'd want to live in Moreno Valley all that much. But there is the allure. I mean, he played at San Diego State. There's the allure of coming back to home, which really you can't overstate for a guy like that. Okay, now I get to be the guy in really one of the cities in the NBA and not be in the hinterlands of Toronto.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to see what he does, and will it depend on how far they go? Will they get to the finals? They're ahead 3-2 right now. They're looking good. Could they potentially win the finals? I don't think they will, but I do think that you mentioned Masai Ujiri. The way that they've treated him this year is they've made it a lot harder on him to make that simple decision of, yeah, I want to go back home and play for the Lakers or the Clippers, which I would guess that the Clippers are the front runner right now. But, you know, to get into this series and the one-name guys, Kawhi against Giannis has really been exciting. Kawhi started guarding him more in Toronto, and that helped Toronto even up the series 2-2. And then Kawhi was excellent in the fourth quarter last night. And if you look at some of the stats between these two guys, I think you see why Toronto is now ahead 3-2 in the series. I looked at the free throws and the three-point shots. So Giannis, from the free throw line in this series, is 30 of 50. That's, of course, 60%. Kawhi is 46 of 50. So he's 92% at the line.
Seriously.
The first two games in the series, he went 10 for 10, both games. And then you look at three-pointers. Giannis is 5 of 16. That's 31%. Kawhi is 10 of 24, 42%. So on those important plays, Kawhi has been the better player. And he was a couple of the big plays in the fourth quarter last night. Brooke Lopez got switched on to him, and Kawhi was able to get himself free and make a three-pointer right over Brooke Lopez. And then that leads us to the play of the game from my perspective, the Brooke Lopez non-box out. And so you talk about fundamentals like Steph Curry honing his craft. One of the things that these centers have to do is be able to box out. Biggest play of the game, Toronto's up two. Kawhi finally misses a shot with 34 seconds left. Brooke Lopez, if he just gets the rebound from Milwaukee, they've got the ball, he come down and tie. But he gets hooked up with Marc Gasol, allows Marc Gasol to get the rebound, and then Lopez immediately fouls him. And he didn't need to, because with 34 seconds left, they could have just played defense. Toronto misses. You get the ball back with 6-7 seconds left, down by two. You go down and tie it or win it. But because Brooke Lopez could not box out Marc Gasol, and then he fouls him right away, and then Gasol makes two free throws, there's the difference. And Milwaukee loses at home, and Toronto is one win away from the finals.
A mere 6 months ago on BucksFilmRoom.com, I quote, "Brooke Lopez is a master of boxing out and allowing his team to collect the glory. At 7 feet tall and 275 pounds, Brooke Lopez is supposed to be one of the elite rebounders in the NBA. His combination of strength and size should theoretically allow him to grab boards in traffic just as easily as when he's the only one in the lane. However, it doesn't quite work that way for Lopez." So thanks to the new, and I ellipsis, thanks to the NBA's new hustle stats they unveiled last winter, we can now see unique stats like screen assists, loose balls recovered, and contested shots. Most importantly for Lopez, we can also see who boxes out the most. So far in the season, and this was back in November, Lopez averages the fifth most box outs per game at 9.9. Well, so you have one of the best boxer outers in the NBA who, well, I guess things didn't quite work out.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that he didn't put in the effort or that he doesn't box out, or, you know, you will see him especially get a lot of offensive rebounds and then he'll dunk it because he's really big and powerful. And he was trying to box out, but he was standing sideways and he kind of got his elbow locked with Marc Gasol. And he just on that particular box out, he failed. And I'm sure he would admit that. And it probably kept him up last night. He didn't do the traditional, you know, get in front of him, get your backside into him and, you know, eliminate that chance that it's just a weird sort of tip that Gasol is able to recover. And so, yes, that's the type of player he is, but he just didn't quite maximize the fundamentals last night on that opportunity.
Yeah, it's tough to see. And we talked about it last week when it comes down to the final seconds or the final shot and how the things that happen late in the game tend to get magnified. The things that happen early in the game don't. So you don't know if there was a play early in the game that resulted in a 5-point swing that could have potentially been a more critical play. It's just the timing of that really can impact things. And ultimately, I don't know, I still would like to see Giannis and the Bucks get to the finals. I think that would be a fun matchup. And I think that's really the NBA's dream matchup, is Giannis and the young Bucks against the Dubs. But the other thing is, you think back to what it used to be like for professional athletes. And the one that comes to mind constantly when I think about this is Mickey Mantle. The stories back in the day of Mickey Mantle being out until all hours and cavorting with who knows what in who knows what bars and doing so with reporters who have filed their story about the game, but kind of have this sort of, hey, Mick, you're going to do you, and I'm going to do me, and we're probably going to be in the same circles, but we have kind of a gentleman's agreement that you're not going to say that I was there, and I'm not going to say that you were there, and that's cool. And you look at how things are in today's world for a professional athlete, where you go anywhere, and immediately it's somebody going, you know, I mean, I remember being at a an establishment in Lawrence, Kansas, and seeing Kirk Heinrich, and it would have been 16 years ago, 17 years ago. It was a while ago.
Was he still in college?
I believe he was with the Bulls at that point. But I remember seeing Heinrich. I think he was with the Bulls at that point. But I remember seeing him there, and not everybody had camera phones at that point. But we had a friend who was working for Sprint, and she busted out her phone. We took a picture. But you weren't going to do anything with it. It was just more of a like, hey, look who we saw last night. Now, everything that these guys do is completely magnified. And the other thing is, nobody, I said it off air, and I still don't know if the physics law is right. It's Newton's law of thermodynamics. For every take, there has to be an equal and opposite take, no matter how bad it might be. And so, while 5 days ago or less, Giannis was literally a Greek god. Like, he was up there with the guy on my shirt, Poseidon, he was up there with everybody else. Now we have reduced him to that lesser category of gods.
Right. Looking at the stats I just went over. Exactly.
I don't think that's true. I still think he's a great player.
Absolutely.
And I think he's in that handful of guys that are in that rarefied air in the NBA. And, hey, I think they're going to have a game 7 in the East. I'm curious to see what happens. Like, this is must-see TV now. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. I mean, Kawhi, you're right. Kawhi was on top of the world when they're up 2-0. They'd won 6 games in a row because they beat the Celtics 4 in a row after losing game 1. Now they've beaten Kawhi twice, and Toronto looked dead. So you got to give a lot of credit to Nick Nurse. You talk about coaches and making changes. Like I said, he put Kawhi on Giannis, and Giannis, I just think that this is going to be, he's the one who came out yesterday and said, we're not going to lay down. We're going to go to Toronto and fight. And you're right. It is must-see TV to see how they respond, see what he comes up with. But either way, he knows that he's going to go back to the drawing board and get a little bit better at shooting to be unstoppable. You know, we talked about in a recent show how he's going to do that. Ben Simmons probably won't. But this is exposing the weakness of Giannis, of why he's not the ultimate. And by the way, he's only 24.
Right.
So he's got time.
I mean, that's the other thing. Like, yeah, it's he has time, but it's entertaining to watch. It was more about how the reporters just flip on guys like it's nothing. And that's, I don't know. You can't, for any of us, imagine if you were to have a day at work that wasn't a day that was up to par because you were tired, or you woke up before the alarm clock and you couldn't go to bed, or you were up too late watching a movie, and on the way out somebody stopped you to interview you and talk to you about your bad day at work and the fact that you only billed 6.2 hours and your typical day you bill 7.5 and not to mention your overall productivity was at 62%, but usually it's at 79%. Your email return time your typical email return time is usually 7.5 minutes, but today it was 14 minutes. Like, I'd be like, I'm going to punch you. Just let me out of the office, dude.
Well, and not to mention, nobody's making it easy for Giannis. They're specifically trying to make it as hard as possible for him, setting up the wall when he drives. One of those possessions late in the game yesterday, he drives to the basket, and what three players does he see right in front of him? Kawhi Leonard, Pascal Siakam, and Marc Gasol. Three outstanding
defenders.
All three of them.
I know.
Right in his face, interrupting his drive. So they've done a great job of making it really tough on Giannis.
Hey, and I guess the last thing before we switch topics real quick, Nick Nurse, you mentioned. Have you looked up his bio?
No.
Okay, dude. Because he's a new name to me, obviously, because I don't know the intricacies of NBA coaching staffs like you do. Played at Northern Iowa in the 80s, was an assistant in Northern Iowa, and then moved over to something called the Derby Storm, which is a British Basketball League franchise, then a head coach at Grandview University. I don't know where Grandview University is, Des Moines, Iowa, when he was 23, then an assistant in South Dakota, and then for 11 years was coaching in Europe. Then he came back stateside and was a coach in the D-League with the Iowa Energy, the Rio Grande Valley Vipers, And then Dwayne Casey hired him to be an assistant on his roster. So you think about this, though. This guy was born in 1967 and was 44. Check that. He was 46, 47 years old, and he was coaching in the D League. And 5 or 6 years later, an NBA coach on the verge of taking his team to the finals.
In his first year as the head coach.
Isn't that insane?
It is.
I mean, you look at the name and you go, you're accustomed to thinking, okay, this is somebody's like flavor of the month, hot coach that, you know, somebody picked up in his 30s and whatever. This guy's paid every due you could imagine.
Yeah, he really has.
And then some. Like, he's paid lifetime's worth of dues. And he was a great coach.
Yeah, he's rising to the occasion.
It's I don't know. It's rewarding to see that. It's like when you see guys who, I think the Angels still have a guy on their broadcast team who was in the minors for 18 years, plying his trade at the lower levels. There's a guy that I worked with
as a broadcaster,
and then wound up in the major leagues. And there's a guy who I worked with for years who was in the California League, who's great, who's now, well, he was in Double A. And then the team that he was working for advanced to AAA. So he's now one, but that's not how it works for broadcasters. Like, you don't advance through the ranks like you do with
playing.
If you're a player. But you look at guys like that and say, sometimes hard work and just showing up and continuing to do your thing pays off. Not always, but it's nice when it does. Like, that's really the end of it. You wanted to talk about Jeopardy.
Yeah, so let's start this Friday show here with some Fox Jeopardy. I'll give you one test here to get us into the trivia mode. Can you spell, and we're talking about these one name NBA giants, can you spell Giannis's last name?
A-N-T-E-T-O-K-O-U-N-P-O.
Oh, so close.
Oh, M-P-O.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Wait, say it again.
Ante.
No, spell it again.
Can I write it down?
No. Yeah, you can write it down.
I was closing my eyes because I had to see the letters.
Well, you made a correction there, and I'm not sure. It sounded like the proper correction, but...
A-N-T-E-T-O... Oh, what is A-N-T-E-T-O-K-O-U-M-P-O?
Oh, you're one off. The N is in there. Your instinct was right. The N is in there before the M. That's what makes it so hard to remember.
Oh, my God. 13 letters.
Jeopardy James would have nailed
like
that.
Like William Van Landingham. Yeah.
So, yeah, we got to give the Jeopardy James update because he's up to almost 2 million. He's averaging almost $80,000 per show, which is, of course, higher than the previous high before he started competing. But last night was fun because he actually had to really work for the victory.
I still haven't watched it.
You got it.
I need to.
It's must-see television. You know, we talked about the ratings. When
somebody made a Jeopardy James infographic with a title that's based upon a Roald Dahl children's book.
Oh, yeah?
James and the Giant Peach. You sent it to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that I didn't even notice that. James and the Giant Wager.
Yes.
Yeah, I went straight to the actual charts. There's six graphs on here.
Yeah, I wonder if when he had won 15 or 16, they had infographics that said James at 15 and James at 16.
Right.
That's like after school specials from the late 70s. Anyway, I digress. Let's go.
Yeah, so if you this is kind of fun. So if you go to Jeopardy's Twitter page, you can see this James and the Giant Wager infographic. And there's some interesting stuff on here, and one of them is looking at the final Jeopardy wagers between James and Ken Jennings, the all-time winner from Jeopardy, who, of course, won 74 in a row. But if you look at those dots on that graph, Ken missed a lot of his final Jeopardy questions. James, on the other hand, what is there, one red X in there? I mean, he's almost perfect. And last night, it was fun because...
That's astonishing.
Because you finally saw somebody who was really using James's style. He was picking the $1,000 clues in Single Jeopardy, trying to build up his bankroll. And he followed the formula that you have to follow to beat him, which is James's formula. get some money, get the daily double. So this guy got the daily double and nailed it. So he had a lead going into Double Jeopardy. And then they both got one of the daily doubles in Double Jeopardy. And James did what he had to do. He went all in on the Double Jeopardy, on the daily double in Double Jeopardy that he got, and he got it. And so he went into Final Jeopardy with about a $5,000 lead, and he was at $30,000. His competitor was at $25,000. And he got this, seemed very difficult question to me about some jazz song from way back when. Of course, he got it and continued his streak. But, you know, he congratulated this competitor on his Twitter page the next day, kind of showing a picture of him giving him a thumbs up and, you know, great competition. So, I think he's somebody to celebrate. He's a humble winner, and he's just fascinating to watch.
So, you know, and I guess there are a few things. One, how does James Holzhauer not have a verified Twitter account yet? Like, how have they not given him the little blue check?
It isn't?
No.
He already has, what, 45,000 followers?
I know, but, like, I realize you have to apply for it, but the guy's got other things going on. Give him the blue check. Like,
right.
Just call it a day. Although they didn't give me a blue check. Jerks. I did apply, but I guess I'm not very important, so, and I'm aware of that.
I mean, even Tom Brady's chiming in.
It's awesome. Like, give him a blue check just so that we can look easier. The other thing is, and you sent the second tweet along that James had sent, where he says, in quotes, "Jeopardy is so boring now. There's no drama anymore. Game of Thrones finale sucked." I say it all the time, and my kids laugh, and I say it more to sound like I'm an old guy than to sound like, I don't know, than really anything, but it's predictable, and I have a lot of very predictable sayings. One of them is, that's why we can't have nice things. And it's more just so that I can really feel like I'm a dad. And it's like full-on dad joke. But things like this are really why we can't or shouldn't have nice things. Like, there are people, and it goes back to Giannis. There are people who sit there and Giannis isn't ready, and this and that, and this is what's wrong with his game and whatever. Like, there's way too much. Going back to it, for every take, there has to be the equal, opposite, negative take. I just kind of miss the old days when that didn't happen all the time. Like, for every point, there doesn't need to be a counterpoint. For every "this guy is great," there doesn't need to be a "this guy sucks, I hated it." And honestly, there's 7 billion people in the world. Everybody has an opinion about something. I don't need to hear most of your opinions.
Yeah, I just think that
really makes me sound like an old guy.
Yeah, I just think that the hate is ridiculous. This guy worked for years and years to get to be proficient at trivia at an all-time high level. So let's just appreciate it and applaud it.
He's destroying people.
But, you know, this is what's happening in society. I sent you the other article about St. Thomas, this Division III school out in Minnesota. And did everybody hear what their conference is doing to them? The Minnesota Intercollegiate Athletic Conference, the MIAC, has told this school, St. Thomas, that if you're going to stay in this conference, we're going to shut it down. We're going to end this conference and disband it.
That
because
sounds nice.
You're too good at athletics. So either you leave, you have to leave so we can continue. If you refuse, we're going to disband. I mean, this is just absurd. Can you imagine if the NFL said to the Patriots, "All right, that's it. You've proven it. You are the best, Bill. Bill Belichick, you're too good. We're finished. The NFL is finished unless you guys quit. You need to sell your team. And Bill Belichick, you can't coach anymore. You have to leave the league or else the NFL is finished."
I don't. The answer to the question is, if you don't like it, be better.
Exactly.
Like, these guys are recruiting well for a reason. Go and learn everything that they're doing and figure out what they're doing. Why are they more appealing? And there's also the factor of winning begets winning. So if you're playing D3 sports, yeah, you're going because of other reasons. I want good academics. You know, D3, obviously, in a lot of cases, you're going for the academic side, but in addition to that, you're also going for, are their facilities nicer? Are they providing a good experience for the kids that are playing there? We don't know any of that sort of stuff, but I have a feeling there's a reason that they can recruit, and it's not because they're doing anything illicit, because again, it's D3.
They've got this football coach, and since he's arrived, they've been dominant. So go out and recruit a comparable, excellent football coach.
Well, it's not even go out and just figure out what players want and why they're recruiting better players. And the formula for years for good college football teams at D1 all the way down, you want the blue chippers. And that's the formula that works for a fantasy league. If you're in a fantasy baseball league or a fantasy football league, I can draft the blue chip obvious guys, but the way that I'm going to win the fantasy football league is by drafting Pat Mahomes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Before he's a known quantity. Mm-hmm. That's what drives it. It's finding the undervalued. It's why the Royals won it in 2000. Won the AL in 2014 and won the World Series in 2015. They found the commodity that people had undervalued, which was speed. The A's turned everything into a juggernaut because they found the undervalued thing on base percentage. And, it's not a matter of Billy Bean ruining baseball. It was a matter of there are these guys who get on base a lot and can make things happen. Okay, great. No team cares about that. They want a guy who's hitting 300. Well, if I have a guy gets on base 40% of the time, and you have a guy who hits 300 and gets on base 32% of the time, who's a more worthwhile player?
Right. Well, if I'm the AFC West, I'm telling Pat Mahomes, if you don't retire, there's no more AFC West. We can't compete with you anymore. We can't win this division, so you have to leave. 50 touchdowns, 5,000 yards in your first season as a starter, you're too good.
The answer should be figure it out. You don't like it, figure it out.
Yeah, it's called but competition.
It's not their problem, it's your problem.
Exactly.
Don't point the finger, pull the thumb. That was a good coach speak right there.
They're all playing under the same salary cap.
Which is zero.
They're all playing by the same rules.
Maybe. College.
I'm talking now about the NFL.
Yes.
You know, it's competition.
Yeah, it's true.
Figure it out.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break. Then we're going to come back with one of the players that I coached this spring, which should be interesting. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox.
And Andrew Hansen.
And as I was sitting around the house today, well, not really sitting around the house, I was doing something, getting ready to leave, and my wife goes, "It would be a really good idea for you to have, since the season just ended yesterday, for you to have one of your players on the radio." And I was like, "God, that is a really good idea."
Here we are.
And here we are. So I went right to the guy who has expressed an interest in potentially having a career on the radio, thinking, hey, might be fun for him to do it. And at some point, too, I wouldn't mind it if we were doing a little Bedford High School baseball and get this guy on with us just to given the opportunity to see behind the scenes, but have utility player. I don't know what to call you, Sam McDonough. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hey, what's up, Coach? Thanks for having me.
Anytime. So year one of high school baseball, we played 9 games.
Yes.
We at one point went almost a month without playing a game, which I credit again to my wife for actually living with me after a month of rain. Because I was I was a bear. I was ready to kill everybody. But aside from the rain, what'd you think of your freshman year of high school baseball?
Well, like you said, the rain was definitely a pain. But besides that, honestly, it was a really great experience. I mean, I've been playing with the same players, all these guys, all my teammates for the past couple of years now. And it was a really great experience to be with them again. And to have you as a coach was a great experience as well. It was a lot of fun. And just we played really well this year. We all got along well, and I think we had a great season, and we all learned a lot, I think.
Yeah, Sam, so I understand that you guys won the Little League State Championship back in 2016.
Yes, we
and
did.
Now all of a sudden you're playing on the big field. So what's it been like to go through that journey with a collection of guys and continue to play together now at the high school level?
Well, honestly, it's been a really great experience. I mean, these guys are all my best friends and my brothers. It's a blessing, but it can be a little bit of a curse as well, in my opinion. But I really enjoy it. You know, like I said, I love these guys, and it's really great getting to play with them. I mean, they're my best friends. So it's obviously a great experience being around them all the time and being able to joke around with them. Like, we know how each other think and everything, but it can also be a little frustrating because sometimes we don't always get to try new positions. We all have, like, the same expectations for each other. So it's also great to, like, branch out like I'm doing this year and playing with different players over the summer. And I think that's going to be a really great experience.
Joined by Bedford freshman baseball player Sam McDonough, who I had the pleasure of coaching this year. And I look at that team, and you're absolutely right. You described it like they're your best friends, but they're your brothers. And even the guys who weren't on that state championship team, you guys had played with and grown up with, which is a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
You guys know each other and each other's tendencies. And it was interesting to me to kind of pick up pretty quickly, there's a pecking order, and you sort of see who messes with whom, but who doesn't mess around with this guy. Seriously, I have two girls. I don't have boys, and it was a really good reminder for this is what 14 and 15 year old boys do. It's hilarious.
No, yeah, absolutely. We are the stereotypical 14, 15 year old boys.
Does that help you out on the field knowing what each other's tendencies will be?
Yes, absolutely. Like, we know with some players, like, some players are a little bit more selfish than others. I'm not going to name names, but I'm sure you know who I'm talking about.
Well, and it's not a knock. It's just sometimes it's a personality thing.
Like, no, exactly. Yeah, I mean,
there's some people
we really
that, yeah.
enjoy. I mean, I would definitely say it helps us play better together. Like, if one of my teammates make a mistake, I'm not afraid to tell them that they messed up and that they have to, like, make an adjustment to that. Like, I know them. They know me. They know I'm not personally going after them. They know I care about them in a personal way and that I want them to be better as a player. And they can. I think that just makes us all better players and better teammates.
That really does. That communication between teammates, that's
yeah.
huge. I mean, to be able to communicate as an adult, it's going to help your team performance, your team chemistry. Since this was your first year at the high school level, and I deal with this guy across the room here every week.
Well, I was going to say, too, we've been teammates on the basketball court. We've been teammates on the softball field. So
we have, but I mean, I got to start thinking here, am I going to keep calling him Lauren, or is he going to be Coach Fox
No, no, dude, no.
But, you know, tell me about his first year at this level coaching you guys, because he's coached and umpired in the lower, younger age groups with baseball, but what's it been like with him as your coach? I know when I talk to him about baseball, he likes to tell stories. You know, is he ever serious with you guys, or is it all, you know, telling jokes and, you know, funny baseball stories?
I'd say it was a good even mixture, honestly. Like, when we're joking around, Coach is really easy to joke around with as well. Like, he's good at telling stories, like you said, and he tells them a lot. And we all got along really well. But he also knew when the time was right to be serious and to, like, be like, hey, guys, look, let's focus. Let's get this right. We got a game tomorrow or the next day. We got to focus on that. We want to get some wins. And I think he did a great job with that.
Now there's got to be some things that he could improve on. I mean, he's obviously a great person to be around. But what should he have done differently in terms of strategy potentially that – you know, may have helped you guys out? What we need to help him learn a little bit here. What could he have done differently?
Well, not to bash you, Coach, but your base running.
Oh, dude, yes. Fact.
Yeah. We collectively as a team, we were a little frustrated with Coach at points when he would send some runners home.
Oh, yeah. Dude, I was frustrated with myself.
I'm sure. But that cost us a couple runs, but we still ended up winning the games probably 99% of the time.
I was going to say, the game that you're thinking of is the game that I'm thinking of, the Keene game, where we had guys on first and second.
Mm-hmm.
Runner on first thought the ball had gotten away from the catcher. He was head down, full head of steam to second base. The runner on second, I was like, all right, they have the runner on first and a run down between first and second. I'm bringing the guy to third. And as the guy on third rounds third base, it occurs to me that there's nobody at the plate. Like, nobody's covering. And I'm thinking, all right, there are a few things that have to happen now. One, they're going to have to tag out the runner going back to first base, collect themselves, make a throw to a moving target that's not there yet. So, all right, I got to run that guy there. And sure enough, they made all the parts of the play. And, hey, you know, got to tip your cap to them. The other one was later in that game where tripled the gap in right center field. The right fielder overthrows the cutoff man. The runner second to third is coming around or is getting to third base. I see the ball bounding away, and I send him. The shortstop somehow goes Jeter out there behind second base, picks up the ball, throws a strike 150 feet, and gets the guy. We lose the game 5-3. So I basically cost us two runs. And yeah, obviously from that, you can tell that I'm still feeling the pain of it. But no, I agree. I will tell you that there were adjustments for me for going from 4660, the little league size field, to
much farther distance.
And 90 feet, I know it from me when I play softball with these guys, and softball is what, 65 or 70 feet. When I go 70 feet, that's a different thing than running on 90-foot bases. Like, there are sometimes I feel like I need to have an oxygen tank going first to third on a single, or like my buddy Sergio says, Foxy, take your speed and divide it in two, and that's what you're at. Take the speed that you think you are and divide it in two, and that's your actual speed.
Well, that got me thinking, Sam. When you were talking about Coach Fox and the base running, I started wondering, did he actually try to demonstrate base running himself?
No. Not with this gimpy leg. No.
Thank goodness.
No.
Honestly, our base running was pretty good. We didn't make a ton of mistakes. There was one game, however, I don't remember the exact situation, but I'm sure Coach will remember. I think it was the first inning. We had bases loaded or runners on first and second, and we ended up getting into a double play because we had made some stupid mistake. Like, I can't really remember the situation, but Coach Fox, do you remember that? Like, I think JJ was involved with it.
No, I just told that story. It was, we had first and second, and it was...
Oh, that's when you were talking about?
Yeah, that was against Keene. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that was my question,
guilty.
Sam, is whenever there's a failure on the baseball field, it's an opportunity to learn and improve. Mm-hmm. And so when Lauren was telling that story in one of our previous shows, he obviously took it to heart and he's trying to improve his coaching and decision making. But I immediately asked, you know, well, were the guys running 100%? And, you know, maybe there's something for the players to learn. So, you know, do you remember if any of the players in any of those situations said, hey, you know, I should have been running harder? Or, you know, in general, you know, were you able this year to, you know, experience failure and then and try and improve from it?
Yeah, definitely. We all experienced a good amount of failure this year. We all had our highs and lows, definitely, especially when running the bases. I think we definitely all did learn that we all just have to kind of like think before we do stuff, which is something my mother always tells me. But
it's a good rule of thumb.
A lot of the times we're just acting on instinct, and that's not always the best thing to do. And I think that's something we definitely learned this year, that you kind of have to think about like where the ball is and like the situational stuff, and you just kind of have to be a smart baseball player. It's not as much of a physical sport as it is a mental sport, and you really got to be smart to be, you know, successful.
And there is also the fine gradation between thinking and thinking too much, where like the guy that we're talking to yesterday made a great catch in foul territory on a foul pop first base side, sliding basically toward
Sam
the...
Sam did that?
Yeah.
Oh,
toward
yes.
the fence on the SAU field.
That's what I'm talking about.
A legit play, but if you had said to him, I'm going to throw the ball up there and have you try to make that play, now all of a sudden he's trying to make calculations. If he just reacts, he's money. Made another play at third base, diving stab, and threw literally from his backside, 125 feet across the diamond, and almost got the runner at first base after this hot shot.
By 3 inches.
I know, seriously. The first baseman had to come off to his right just a tiny bit and didn't get back all the way. But it was a great play on his part, too.
He threw it from his backside.
Uh-huh.
Like Vlad Guerrero Jr. just
did.
Were
you laying down or did you get back seated again?
No, I was laying down.
Yeah.
I mean, I picked it. I dove and I grabbed the ball. And then I heard, I think it was Evan Kaplow say, eat it, like tell me not to throw it. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to throw the ball. So I chucked the ball over there. I think I was still on my back. I might have like sat up a second just to get a little bit more leverage and momentum. And I missed it by like 2 inches. And that killed me.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. The fun, and I can say this from years and years and years of playing, it's difficult. The plays that you don't make stick out in your mind, and I don't know why that is. Even if they're completely insignificant, the plays that you stick out in your mind much more than the great plays that you do, or the ones where, you know, I could still tell you chapter and verse of making a diving catch on a sinking line drive in a ridiculous Bedford Men's Softball League game, and the umpire looked at it and much like yesterday, called out and then called the ball hit the ground. And I was already from left
running
center,
off the field.
Left center field, I was gone. Like, I was done. And next thing you know, I'm, like, ballistic or, you know, going, you know, 80 feet to your left for a ball and getting to it and stretching and catching and diving, and the thing pops out. You're like, oh, dude. Like, for some reason, I remember those more than I do the ones that I've made. Painful. I don't know. Hansen's mileage may vary, but.
Well, I feel like I remember them both, but, you know, with the ones you miss, yeah, that's how you get better. And if you feel that negative motivation, that's how you improve over time.
Yeah. So anyway, enough about that. You got summer coming. You said you have some tournaments that you're playing in, and then, I mean, I can't believe it. Like, I Googled a picture a few days ago of the 2016 team. And it's funny. You see, like, babyface Cade Corbett and
LaRochelle. Oh, I know. Yeah, no, some of us.
Like,
we've had some growth.
You guys look like puppies. And
we do.
So, and that wasn't that long ago. Or Facebook will tell me this is what you were doing 4 years. I think this one was 3 or 4 years ago. And I look and I'm like, Maggie looks like a tiny person. Uh-huh. Or 5 years ago, I look and it's, you know, we're on the double A field. Like, things start to really happen really quick. What do you have planned for the summer as far as baseball goes? And then, you know, have you given thought to anything after high school?
As far as baseball goes this summer, I mean, I'm on a really great team with New England baseball or Northeast baseball, excuse me. And I'm really looking forward to that. We're going to be doing a lot of big tournaments this summer. And it's a big roster. It's a big team. But I feel like we're going to have a really great experience with that. And that's going to be a really great thing for me. And as far as baseball goes and my life goes after high school, I mean, overall goal involving baseball is to play baseball in college. I don't know if I can make it farther than that, but I love to play baseball in college. I like to row crew in college. That's also another one of my goals. But after college, we'll see what happens. But after high school, it's just like finding success in sports and school and college and just living a happy life after that.
It's awesome.
That's a nice combo, crew and baseball. I haven't heard that much, but I like it because with crew, you got to really work your back, biceps,
forearms.
Oh, yeah.
No, you get tons of strength from crew.
So
it's insane.
That should help you. So definitely wish you the best of luck with that journey.
Thank you.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for putting up with me and my lousy base coaching. And
absolutely.
I know. I'll see you soon.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you, man.
Take care. All right. That was Sam McDonough, who I had the pleasure of coaching this past year. And, yeah, it's always interesting to look at the dynamic and the dynamic that these guys have, being that they have been together for a really long time. And great group of kids who know their each other's buttons and sometimes push those buttons and sometimes opt not to push the buttons. And it's you almost look. I was looking at these kids and they sort of materialized like their characters in a show, that they have tendencies both on and off the field, and they have certain stereotypes that they may fall into. And it was an educational experience. And to anybody, and I know a lot of people will sit there and say, kids today, this and that. These kids have way more to deal with than we did when we were 14 or 15, as far as social media, as far as having phones, as far as things that are challenging. And I've said it in context, talking about like Maddie, Luke, and Tony, and the amount of balls that she has in the air, whether it's football or pucks, I guess, as it were, like football, softball, hockey, whatever. And somehow these kids manage to navigate a really complicated existence. And I don't think they're given credit for that. And I also don't think a lot of these kids are given credit for the things that they sort of selflessly do. Like, there are some really good kids out there. I think people tend to be really quick to generalize. And I don't think that's fair. So you look like you were going to say something. That was why I cut off that thought.
No, I don't. It's just fun to hear you look back on that. And, you know, you kind of mentioned that it was an educational experience, and it was for them as well. So fun to hear about the growth together.
Yeah, it was very entertaining. So did we? I feel like we had something else we were going to talk about, but
we're going to talk the Atlanta Braves. farmhand who didn't sign.
Yeah, we are literally at 1 hour.
Ah.
So we're not going to talk about that this week. We're going to talk about it next week. So thank you to the crew here at Bedford 105.1, Harry, Bill, and Colleen for all that they do. Thanks to our special guest, Sam McDonough of the Bedford High freshman baseball team. And thank you to everybody for listening. Have a great sports week. Good luck to the Bulldog baseball team and I guess all the other Bedford teams that are moving on into the playoffs. Wish you nothing but the best as we march toward the end of the school year. For Andrew Hansen, I'm Lauren Fox. Have a great sports week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.